from Buffalo Toronto Public Media. This is What's Next, an hour dedicated to amplifying the voices of marginalized and underrepresented communities across Western New York and Southern Ontario.
We cannot erase, we cannot reform, we cannot make things better if we're uncomfortable having tough conversations,
Absolutely.
If we're uncomfortable Absolutely. Talking about race.
What's Next carries forward our mission to engage in meaningful conversations about race, equity, and the shared concerns that deeply affect Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
Don't stop. Make those families part of your life. Their lives are part of yours. Don't stop.
Together, we dive into the real issues, striving for understanding, connection, and change.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our children.
Welcome to WBFO's What's Next. I'm Naila Ansari Carbonell-Cotillo, and today we're discussing a significant initiative with the University of Buffalo School of Social Work to address the shortage of school-based mental health professionals in rural areas. I have Dr. Katie Stalker here and Dr. Anna Ball. Welcome to What's Next.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
I'm excited to be here today because mental health is something that's very special and dear to my heart. I know we chatted a little bit before we just got on air, but I'm going to dive right into it because you all got some amazing news. You got $3.59 million. So kudos to you all from the Department of Education. Can you talk a little bit about that, Dr. Stalker?
Sure. So we received an award from the U.S. Department of Education to develop a fellowship to train UB social work graduate students in rural school mental health.
That's awesome. Dr. Ball, can you talk a little bit about the importance of mental health in rural areas?
Yeah, I mean, nationally, there's a youth mental health crisis that they've seen just kind of globally across youth in the sense that kids are really struggling with mental health issues right now, and that looks different across different regions and different communities. And so one of the things that we wanted to focus on with this grant was particularly rural mental health and youth mental health in rural areas. And again, rural mental health doesn't look the same, but in Western New York, that we have some communities that are pretty similar in terms of what they need.
Which is interesting because I think a lot of times you have this idea of what mental health is, and oftentimes we really do look at kind of these more urban cities, as I say, or populated cities. Can you talk a little bit about, and this can go for both of you, in terms of like, what is mental health? How do you all kind of categorize mental health? Because, you know, we all hear these terms of, you know, narcissism all the way, depression, and all these things are kind of been like buzzwords, but what really is mental health? And I'll, you know, go with both of you.
Well, I can start and say, you know, mental health, really, we're talking about well-being. It's a component of well-being. And when we talk about mental health, we don't just mean specific disorders or extreme mental illness. It also includes just even positive mental health. So how often are you feeling joy? How often are you feeling happy? Gratitude. And so that's one of the important things to understand with the youth mental health crisis is that we definitely have more numbers of kids experiencing anxiety and depression and suicide, you know, ideation. But it's also kids are just kind of reporting feeling sad and lonely. And that's a component of mental health, too, that's really important, even if it doesn't get to the point of a severe impairment.
Dr. Stalker.
Yeah, I mean, I think I just totally agree with that. It's I think we can get stuck on the disorders and the percentages of people who have been diagnosed or youth who have been diagnosed with particular disorders, but it's more general than that. I think the term you used, Anna, well-being, really, really encapsulates that.
So this fellowship, you know, a lot of folks that may have not gone to grad school may not really understand how fellowships work. What is the specific training that these graduate students will be getting in order to go into these rural communities?
I can get us started with that. So students will receive course training. So they're going to gain the information, the knowledge, the theory around mental health in rural communities, but there's also an internship or field placement component. So they'll actually be working alongside social workers in rural school districts, working with students and families in rural schools.
Oh, wonderful. Dr. Ball.
I think the other component of a fellowship that's exciting is that it's a group of students who are all focused on doing the same thing with the same interest area. And so we're able to focus the stuff that we do in coursework, but also in their internship, so that it's really targeted towards this ultimate goal that we have around reducing youth mental health issues in rural areas. So Katie mentioned the coursework. We also have a seminar that students are going to participate in that's specifically focused on evidence-based practices around mental health in schools in rural areas, which is not something that we would normally have a whole lot of time to carve out in regular coursework.
I was actually going to ask about that, because usually, you know, graduate students are kind of like, I want to get right on the ground, and they tend to want to be in these big populated areas. What has been kind of the feeling with these graduate students and fellows of actually having to go to rural communities, particularly ones that have not been to rural communities very often? Mm-hmm.
So I think one of the unique things about the fellowships is we're kind of addressing some of the barriers with graduate students wanting to go, wanting to travel those far distances to more rural areas. We are able through the fellowship to provide mileage reimbursement. So students are able to, you know, offset that cost associated with traveling to those rural areas. And we're about to begin recruitment. So to answer your question about how are they feeling, well, we'll let you know once we find out. But I think the fellowship is structured in such a way that we're able to pay students a stipend for their internship experience generally, and the mileage reimbursement. And as needed, we'll also be able to cover some childcare expenses that students might incur while they're completing their internships at the school placements. So I think that they're, all of the barriers that there are, we're doing our best to get those out of the way, though, so that students can get to those rural schools to learn alongside the social workers.
Oh, that's wonderful. Mm-hmm. What impact do you anticipate this will have in rural communities? Because I know we have a lot of social workers, and some people would argue in the city we probably don't have enough, mm-hmm. right? So what does it look like to actually have more social workers, more folks that are really into mental health in these rural areas?
I mean, just as an example, in most schools in Buffalo Public, there's a school social worker. Mm-hmm. That's not the case at all in rural districts. Usually there is one social worker for the whole district. So just having, even as students, having them there, being able to work with kids and consult with teachers and help the existing practitioners in the building is a huge benefit. We figured it out, I don't remember exactly, but it would actually improve the ratio of mental health providers to students just by having them as interns there. And the hope is that ultimately we're able to get more people trained to be able to work in rural areas so that they seek out jobs and get jobs in rural areas, so that ultimately we can increase the number of providers who are just on the ground mm-hmm. to do that.
Can you talk a little bit about the importance of social workers in schools? I think some parents may not even know that they really exist. And if they do, they don't really know what they're going there for. If their kid may have some issues, they're like, you know, maybe take them out of the school and finding therapy. But what's the importance of social workers inside schools?
So I think of social workers in schools as addressing all of those things that get in the way of academics. So the behaviors or what's going on socially or emotionally for students. Social workers are able to address those barriers to get students at a place where they're able to learn, in some cases, so that they're able to actually attend and show up to school. Anna, if you have anything to add to that.
Yeah, I mean, that's really their primary purpose, is to advance education and do that through all the ways that are sort of considered non-academic. And then also, I mean, schools are centers for communities, and that's usually where issues that families are experiencing show up first. So social workers in schools are like sort of frontline people to identify needs and then help connect people to resources. So not just kids, but families too. Mm-hmm. So anything from basic needs, food, clothing, to mental health care.
Mm-hmm. And you have a partnership with Erie BOCES. Can you talk a little bit about that? What's that collaboration look like?
They're a wonderful partner. I am not from New York, so it took me a while to understand what BOCES does and what their role is. And I think many people still don't always know. Mm-hmm. But what I have learned is that they are really important in getting information and resources out to school districts. And so by partnering with BOCES, we're able to reach a broader scope of school districts than we would probably be able to reach if we were just partnering individually with each district. Mm-hmm. And then they can also help us understand the best way to maybe roll out a new training that we want to do, or that something that our students, an initiative they might want to do in their buildings. And so BOCES is really good at coordinating across districts and across the region. And they also pointed out to us the significant need in the rural schools. Mm-hmm. We didn't have a specific preference or idea. And they said, well, you know, these districts are really looking for support. And we wouldn't have known that without partnering with BOCES.
So there's this idea of a rural knowledge gap. Can you explain that to me? I was reading up on it. I was like, oh, this is interesting. The rural knowledge gap. What is that?
I might pass it over to you.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think what many of us are familiar with is going into larger cities to get graduate training, mm-hmm. because that's where the universities are located. And that training, though, doesn't always translate to rural areas. And also because of that, the barriers that people in rural areas face to higher education prevent large numbers of people from rural areas being represented. So you just end up with this concentration of people who have mostly urban experience, mostly urban training. Mm-hmm. And then they don't know how to translate that to rural areas. And so it becomes a knowledge gap where, mm-hmm. you know, something, an example, confidentiality in schools, social workers are trained very much to maintain confidentiality, ensure that you don't share student information or family information with other people in the school building. In a rural area, the parent you're working with might be a teacher in the elementary school.
Right.
So it's hard to know. They have to know how to navigate that differently. So that would be an example of a knowledge gap specific to rural areas.
What are some other differences that you all see in terms of children that are growing up in a city environment, in a more populated environment, versus children that are growing up in these rural communities?
I think that a lot of times there's a picture that's painted about rural communities and how it's kind of idyllic, and it's not plagued with the social problems that urban areas are, but that's just not true. So the same social problems that we see in urban areas, poverty, drug use and addiction, those are also, they also exist in rural areas. So I think that youth in rural areas and rural communities are facing these same issues, but rural areas may not have the same resources, the same mm-hmm. number of resources as youth in urban areas may have. And then even when those resources do exist, they could be spread really far apart. And so there's transportation, there's still access issues. So it's youth are facing the same issues, you know, at the community, family, peer level, but there isn't necessarily the same level of resources for them compared to other youth.
So with this program, it seems like a lot of folks will benefit, you know, folks that are, you know, going to rural areas for the first time, and then folks that are in rural communities that are really trying to get connections with these different social workers, different counselors that are in the school. What benefits do you think this new program that you all will have in both our graduate students that are in an urban setting at the University of Buffalo and the rural students that will be getting a lot of the programming?
I think we could, I don't think we talked about a particular part of the fellowship called the UB Stars component.
Yes,
of the fellowship, and I think this speaks to your question. In addition to the fellowship as we've described it so far, there's a UB STARS component, which stands for Small Town and Rural Schools. And with this component, we're actually recruiting students to UB from the rural communities. So we want to get rural community members to become students at the UB School of Social Work, with the idea that we'll train them in the same fellowship, the same seminars that Anna was mentioning, the field placements, and we'll train them up to be social workers. And then they'll go back to their rural communities and, you know, be a mental health service provider there. So in that way, we're addressing like the workforce shortage that we see related to mental health in rural communities. So I think that's a huge benefit to those individual fellows who are going to support through the social work training, but also the rural communities that they'll go back to and intern serve.
So you're getting that nice pipeline.
The pipeline, yeah. Exactly.
And also, I think it helps in terms of experience, right? It helps when you're from those environments because you understand the people, you understand the community, you understand the culture, mm-hmm. and there's not much of a, like, invitation to have to be had to, in order to come exactly. into that community. So it's really a twofold program. Where do you see this program growing outside of the initial kind of funding period?
So I think we're thinking about sustainability from the beginning. I mean, one of the simplest thing that I think that this fellowship is creating is those partnerships with the rural schools. So within the UB School of Social Work, all of our students do 2 internships throughout their time with us. And the 4 school districts that we've been working with, we actually do not currently have partnerships with. So these partnerships were actually developed as part of this grant and this fellowship. And so I definitely think that we'll be sure that continues and we continue to build capacity by sending students in internships and field placements in the rural districts.
Dr. Ball, what does success look like for you all?
I think, as an institution of higher education, we absolutely want our students to graduate and pursue careers in the field. And in this case, particularly around school practice and rural schools. So that would be, I think, a huge indicator of success for us. Also, on the other end, though, I think the schools having positive experiences, as Katie mentioned, they're new partners for the school social work and helping schools see, not that they see the value of having these practitioners, but it's something that there's numerous priorities in school districts. So I think success would also mean that more kids are getting services. Maybe there are improvements in their processes in the district that our students have been able to contribute to. And that they, they in turn value having UB students work with them.
It's much needed. So I've been learning so much from both of you. And I feel like I'm a graduate student right now trying to get ready to go into the field. But I know you both have very kind of specific expertise, and I'm going to go with both of you. I'll start with Dr. Ball first to tell us a little bit about the work that you do and how this will help in the fellowship in terms of your expertise.
Yeah, I'm so excited about this fellowship because this sits kind of right in my wheelhouse. I focus on school social work practice and particularly around the ways that school mental health supports family engagement and social emotional learning are pathways to educational justice. So I see everything that I do in those areas as ways to help all kids achieve the educational outcomes that are possible for them. So it's really meaningful that we're able to do the work and one, bring more people to schools to do the work in the buildings, but also to train students to be, to come out with the newest, best evidence-based knowledge. And then they can bring that to the districts. And they do, we see it happen with our students. They're taking a class and then they go to their internship and they're like, I just read about that in my class. And then they tell their field instructor all about it. And they're like, oh, that's great. I didn't know that. So I think that's a really nice dynamic between universities and communities that I think kind of goes under the radar sometimes.
Yeah, it's that experiential learning. So often we think that it's just theoretical or just reading things in books. So to be able to take that, I love that term educational justice, right? Mm-hmm. To be able to take that thought process and put it into actual work that goes kind of outside of this academic world that mm-hmm. most people kind of think folks live in all the time, which they know they don't. Dr. Saka, can you talk a little bit about your expertise and how that will help with this fellowship?
Yeah, sure. So my work is pretty broad. So I do community-centered prevention. So the way that I describe that is working with communities to identify strategies to address issues that they're finding, that they want to address, and that they have energy to address in their own communities. And so one of the things that we have done in structuring the development of this fellowship is that we have a leadership advisory board that we're going to stand up very soon. And there will be representatives from BOCES and each of the school districts. And they're going to help us really design the fellowship. So the seminars that we mentioned earlier in terms of the topics, we have some idea based on research on rural youth mental health, but some of that might be true for rural communities in Western New York and some of that might not, right? So we are building in those conversations so that the folks that are in the schools and know really what our students who are going to be doing their field placements in the schools, what do they need to know? And so so there's room. It's not like the fellowship is totally developed. We're developing it in partnership with the communities and with the school districts.
Which is great because the notion that community is involved in the research is helpful because community is usually not involved.
Right.
Right. It normally works the other way. It's like, hey, we just did all this research and we're going to come here and we're just going to implement it. So to be able to have folks get involved is really important so that this fellowship can really be holistic in its approach.
Right.
When you talk about your students that you're bringing in or want to bring in from the rural communities, do you feel like there's going to be a certain kind of development that you're going to have? Because it might be a huge shift from them from where they're used to living into going to this like kind of bigger city, and UB is a massive institution. Do you feel like there's going to have to be a little bit of help in terms of getting folks familiar with the city environment that are coming from rural communities?
I think there's definitely a possible. It's interesting because I don't think we really have a good idea of who these students will be. Like we need help from the district. Because we don't necessarily, like I remember when we were applying for the grant, I made a phone call to one of the districts and the person on the phone said, oh, you know, I did social work for a little while and I thought, do you want to be one of our... So I think it'll probably be very individualized. I also think I sort of expect, I don't know if Katie thinks this too, that some of the students might be older. They may already have some professional experience in the schools or in some of the agencies in the areas. And so, you know, they have to want to undertake graduate education. And I don't know if they will. So that might be an adjustment, which we've seen with other students who have had some practice experience and come to our program. So I don't think that's something we're unprepared for, but it's always a learning curve, I think, for our students.
Yeah, it's definitely a shift of being in two different worlds, right? Trying to navigate that academic world while also trying to navigate this experiential world in time, right? Like there's like there's not enough hours in the day to do grad school sometimes and also trying to get through the experiential part of the programming. Dr. Stocker, when you talk about the community, how important is it to have feedback, not just from the districts, but from the folks that are living in the communities as well?
Yeah, that's a really important point. And as you were talking earlier about, oh, that's not the way that research usually does, you're absolutely right. So a lot of times researchers will go to communities with... you know, with the plan already set, and maybe I'll get some feedback, but I do think that what we're trying to do is, again, like from the beginning, we want to do what makes sense in terms of structuring the fellowship and identifying like the topics and things that the seminars will focus on from the beginning. So we're going, we're starting with an open mind, and we want as many folks as want to be involved, and we'll be sure to create opportunities to hear those voices from the community.
It's interesting because I am thinking about mental health and I'm thinking about when I was in school, and I actually don't remember too many of my counselors even having those kind of conversations. And I think that mental health has now kind of been more commercialized in certain ways. Are you finding that there's more of a need for social workers in schools now?
I think the need was there. It's always been there, but the stigma, and it's still there too, but it has gone down a bit, I think, with just the national conversations around mental health. And so, I mean, one of the things that the schools told us is they have so many kids that want help and they're having a hard time finding providers. Even if they partner with outside community agencies, the agencies don't have the workforce to support it either. So I do think there's more kids asking. I also think schools have changed their culture a bit and really see the value of helping kids with their mental health in sort of pursuit of their educational outcomes that the schools have always been, you know, really focused on. So it's important that we look at a whole child. And I think schools really agree with that now. And so they're recognizing the importance of bringing in mental health supports too. And there's been a lot more federal and state attention on mental health at the same time for youth and a school-based approach.
Wonderful. Well, we're going to head into a break with Dr. Stocker and Dr. Ball. We'll be right back with WBFO's What's Next.
This is Jack Cruiser with The Scoreboard on WBFO. Listen during Morning Edition and All Things Considered each Monday, Wednesday, and Friday for the latest on pro matchups and college rivalries, as well as standout local athletes from Western New York and Southern Ontario. Want more? Listen to a longer version of The Scoreboard at WBFO.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues of our communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the WBFO app, and we will work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern that we should be addressing? Email whatsnext@wbfo.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that are needed. This is WBFO, your NPR station.
Welcome back to WBFO's What's Next. I'm Naila Ansari-Carbonell-Cotillo, and I'm with Dr. Stocker and Dr. Ball from the University of Buffalo Social Work. And you all just got a phenomenal $3.59 million grant for those that are just coming in from the Department of Education. So we are talking about mental health in rural communities. So can we talk a little bit about the stigma of mental health? And what we talked about right before we went on our last break of, you know, folks trying to kind of navigate, what is mental health? Is it okay for us to get help? Are we open to getting help? What does that look like? What are some of the stigmas that you're finding, particularly with kids? And then we'll go with parents.
I think there's, before we went on break, Anna mentioned that stigma has improved over time. And I totally agree with that in the general sense. I think it can still be a real issue in rural areas in particular. And stigma can really get in the way of accessing services. So as a parent, if you started to notice some things with your kid that you're worried about, you would might reach out to a teacher and get their advice, or you might try and reach out to another parent and see if they have some sort of similar experience and maybe there's a provider that they saw. But if there's a stigma around mental health in your community, you're not talking about it. Mm-hmm. And because you're not talking about it, you're not reaching out to mental health service providers to set up services, or reaching out to the school for a social worker potentially to talk to you, to your kid. So I think that with the fellowship, I think for sure that is something that we are going to spend a lot of time training our students on as they work with students in rural schools.
What are some things that you would maybe share with parents about wanting to get help? Because that, you know, sometimes it really comes from the parents first before it goes to the kids with the stigma. What are ways that you can make parents feel comfortable in having their kids see different social workers at their schools?
I mean, I think one huge thing that parents can do is just talk about mental health mm-hmm. in ways that are really accessible and normal for kids. I'm just kind of having a sad day, or, you know, I really don't feel like doing this. I've been kind of down lately. Just sort of talking, like being open about that, makes space for kids to do that in return. And then if you're thinking there might be something going on, approaching the topic and listening. I mean, really, that's an important piece. It's not coming with a solution or coming with, you know, I think you need this, so I'm going to make this phone call. But, you know, what do you think would help, or how is this bothering you? And having open conversations. But I mean, definitely normalizing can make a huge impact. And stigma is still in the research. It's been identified as the number one barrier for kids to seek help in schools.
Yeah, because there's like that embarrassment, especially if you're in a school environment, you don't know who's listening, who might find out, if your teachers find out. Mm-hmm. So it's that kind of trust factor too that I think tends to need to be built in the schools, which I think are there. But a lot of times if students don't feel comfortable going, you don't even know if you can build trust unless they go and seek that help. It's interesting because as we're talking about this, I'm automatically thinking of COVID and isolation and drug use being kind of like exacerbated. And maybe I don't know all the data on that, but it seemed that it appeared that it was super exacerbated. And I know that students that I have, isolation is huge. And this is more in the city environment. Have you seen isolation also being exacerbated in drug use in rural communities?
Yeah, I mean, it is. The Surgeon General released a report a couple of years ago around loneliness and social isolation. So it's definitely a national concern and very present. And even the data that kids have reported, the national surveys, kids have reported more loneliness in rural areas. It's interesting with all this technology, we're always saying, you know, it's a way to connect, but people are still lonely. Mm-hmm. And so that is an issue. I don't know exactly about its relation to substance use, but that is also a concern in rural areas.
Mm-hmm. You just kind of mentioned social media in this technology age. I've noticed with a lot of students I have that are college-based students, it's hard for them to have to kind of have these one-on-one point of contact with people. Have you found that in terms of your research and building this community and this fellowship, that social media is also creating this more isolated effect and students not really wanting to kind of engage with different social workers in schools?
I'm not sure what you would think.
I think that's a good question for the folks in the buildings when we have those conversations. But I think, again, like in terms of when we're thinking about topics and what do we want to discuss and what do we want our fellows to learn, social media is also top of the list. Yeah.
It's huge right now, especially because a lot of the kids now, that's all they know. You know, we kind of grew up in an area where, mm-hmm. you know, social media didn't really come till like our college, you know, mm-hmm. undergrad, you know, high school world. Like now they have it at like 2 years old on iPads. Right. So they're isolated in the sense of like they don't actually have to talk to people to go and hang out and have fun. It's just right there in their hands all the time. And, you know, kids getting cell phones really mm-hmm. young now. So it's interesting to kind of see the impact of technology with students across the board.
It's hard because schools have to make decisions without, like, we don't have research on that. Like, we don't know enough yet, but schools still have to make decisions. So I know our students from UB will be thrown into conversations about cell phone bans in schools, and
they don't know
any more than, you know, the rest of us do. So that will definitely be, I'm sure we'll talk about it the entire time.
Yeah. it's I feel like it's huge right now of folks trying to figure out like what are the side effects of social media and what are the side effects of it always being, you know, activated and always accessible mm-hmm. to folks. When we talk about rural communities, what are some of the biggest findings that you all are seeing amongst students across the board that they're having difficulties with? Is it depression? Is it different mental health things that you all are seeing?
I mean, we know anxiety and depression mm-hmm. are high. Substance use is also something that is a problem. It depends, that differs kind of with the areas, but that is generally an issue too. LGBTQ youth report worse mental health in rural areas. At the same time, those who are in schools that have more supports targeted for LGBTQ youth do better. Mm-hmm. So it's not, you know, it doesn't have to be that way. But I'm trying to think, those are probably the largest things that we know from the literature.
I don't know if you had anything else. And then the social isolation right. piece as well. Mm-hmm. So.
Mm-hmm. Do you think we have a new administration coming in, right? We just had a surgeon general that was really into loneliness and isolation, which is helpful for you all in terms of mental health. Do you feel that a new administration coming in is something that will kind of hinder this fellowship in terms of like what you all will be able to have access to, including, you know, inclusion, equity, LGBTQ rights? Or do you feel like, you know, you're still going to have to just champion through no matter what administration is there?
I think we're championing the administration because, yeah, those are many of the topics that that we included in our grant that we plan to address.
Yes. So what do you say to people that don't think mental health is real? Like there's definitely, I would say, an older generation of folks that are like, that's not real. You don't have anxiety. Just get your bootstraps on and go to work. Mm-hmm. What do you all think about that? How do you get those folks? I don't know if you get them to change, but what are some things you might say in terms of trying to get them to understand mental health a little bit better?
I wonder, something that just came to mind, like coping skills, like kind of anchoring the conversation in something that's a little more concrete. You know, if you're having a bad day, is there something that you do to make yourself feel better? And I probably would word that differently. Yeah. But yeah, I think trying to have the conversation about mental health in a way that, that might be more like tangible, concrete.
I was thinking the same thing.
Yeah,
I know. I was thinking when I lived in a previous state, that was much more common.
Yeah.
And even among students that I taught. And, you know, I think you can have all kinds of ideas about the cause. So, like, it could be like a moral character defect, right? Or it could be religious, right? But you're still going to do something about it, right? Like, so I think focusing on what you can do. And maybe you don't have to go to formal mental health care, right? Like maybe there's a lot of other things that could happen. So I think that's an important piece to emphasize. Even just emphasizing that mental health isn't just mental illness is, is helpful when people have ideas about what mental health is or is not.
And really break it down exactly what mental health is, I think is helpful for everyone.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say, and especially in terms of like diagnoses, I don't think we should waste our breath talking about whether anxiety is real or not.
Right.
Like, let's let's talk about you know, some of those symptoms and feelings, you know, rather than necessarily
the actual diagnosis of
it.
Because I feel like everyone's diagnosing now. I think everybody has like a podcast. Yeah. And they have, like, a psychologist. I was like, I think you have this.
Yeah.
Now, well, I do feel like, maybe it's just me, it does feel like there's more people kind of, I don't know if it's they're acknowledging they have mental health or they are actually getting diagnosed. Do you feel that there are more people that are actually coming out that have mental health struggles? Or do you feel like it's actually pretty much the same number, but people are actually acknowledging that they might have mental health struggles?
That's a good question. And I don't know that we have the data. Like, I don't know that we know. With most things, it's a combination of some increases and probably due to things like social isolation, the pandemic, right? The economy, I can think of many things. But also the fact that it was likely also there before too. And we've gotten better at identifying and diagnosing and referring people. So I mean, my guess is it's a combination. And it is more common in the discourse than it was before. Still not, we still haven't achieved no stigma, but, but you, like you said, you hear it in podcasts, people talking about trauma for one, right? A lot more than ever before. That was not something people really would openly say, or even just this assumption that most people have experienced trauma. Most, I think, you know, 20 years ago, people would say, oh, trauma is like only really, really bad things.
Which now that we know that there's like so many effects on the brain, like daily, that people have, you know, whether it's the race or, you know, different social determinants of health that get folks to totally feel traumatic every day and they don't even recognize that's what it is. When you talk about this, the rural community and this fellowship, do you see this program being able to really impact that stigma? Just because you're going to have more people there, you're going to have more people talking about it.
So I think one of the things maybe we haven't talked about yet is one of the roles that school social workers can take is implementing like universal school-wide mental health programs. So that's kind of, for lack of a better term, kind of like sneaking in the mental health stuff, right? So it's not about a social worker going and taking a student out for counseling, but instead it's implementing some sort of like social-emotional learning program, like increasing those coping skills like we were talking about too. And so I think that there's lots of opportunities. And so if there's a particular community that is really anti mental health and worried about that, I think that there are other things that school social workers do, especially when there's more of them, when we're increasing their capacity by providing students as interns, where we can do some, you know, school-wide programming kind of focused on wellness, on student well-being.
So I have to say, my son has emotional learning in school, and I have to say that he comes home, Noah, and like totally talks about his feelings. I never did when I was in school. And so that does help to be able to get teachers outside of just putting a lot of that work on the social workers, that it can be implemented school-wide, and what does that programming look like? Is there a way for you all to be able to get the schools, if they're not really necessarily on board with social emotional learning, is there a way that you all with this fellowship will be able to get the schools to kind of get on board to help you all expand this idea of the fellowship to be able to help with mental health across the board throughout the school?
I mean, I think many of the schools are on board, and we're rapidly getting to the point where schools are required to do much of that, whether mm-hmm. they want to or not. I think the benefit of having students do experiential learning in the schools is that they will be really good at understanding what might work best for that individual school. And so I think they'll be, and we'll help them, but they'll be able to say like, well, they don't really have the staffing to implement this program. So could we modify that so it's easier? You know, like I think that's the beauty of the model that we have for social work education, that, you know, things look nice on paper, but when they actually get implemented, they're usually messy mm-hmm. and complicated. And so students kind of bridging that gap is really important. And they'll be, I think, really good navigators for the districts to help them do that.
Well, we're going to head to our next break. This is WBFO What's Next, and we'll be back.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues of our communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the WBFO app, and we will work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern that we should be addressing? Email whatsnext@wbfo.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that are needed. This is WBFO, your NPR station.
Welcome back to WBFO's What's Next. I'm Naila Ansari Carbonell-Cotillo, and I'm with Dr. Stalker and Dr. Ball from the University of Buffalo Department of Social Work, who has an amazing fellowship opportunity with a $3.5 million grant that you all just got. So welcome back to folks that have been listening, and welcome for folks that are just now tuning in. I'm so excited about this initiative. You all have me like going now. I just want to look up some more things. So you all are working with different districts in rural communities. Can you talk about what districts you all will be working with in this fellowship program?
Sure. So we'll be working with Akron, Alden, Niagara-Wheatfield, and Medina school districts.
Oh, awesome. How many schools roughly are we still kind of getting that on board? A lot of schools that you're going to kind of be managing within those districts?
Yeah, so within the four districts, we'll be working with six specific schools.
Wonderful. And so this fellowship, I know we talked earlier about the UB Stars, but this is the rural, small towns and rural schools. I got that.
Yes,
I got
that's
that
right.
And with this program, we're really focusing on rural communities and mental health. And we've kind of been on a roll here talking about mental health and kind of all the things and the different stigmas that's been going around. To our listeners, what help can folks have in their own communities, even if they're not licensed social workers or, you know, they're not therapists, but they might see, you know, a student or a neighbor that might need some help? What are some things that they can do?
I mean, the first thing that comes to mind is, again, the stigma. Mm-hmm. Just being willing to have those conversations. And, you know, it can be scary to, you know, to be on the end where you are entering a conversation with someone, you don't know what they're going to say. You don't know if it could be an emergency, and maybe you don't know that you're prepared to deal with that. Right. So I think just being willing to have kind of base level conversations about how people are doing and, you know, asking like, it seems like you're struggling, you know, can I help? I think is really a good place to start. And then you can have conversations about what that person might need or what they might want, and go back and look that up, right?
And people also being honest about those conversations, right? Like if I'm a teacher and I ask a student how they're doing and they lie to me, I don't really know that they need the help. So if they're honest with me, then I can say, you know what, maybe we need to go head down to the counselor because, you know, this seems like a little, you know, not normal or out of you know, sync of who you typically are, you know, in classes. So I think that works, you know, both ways of us being more transparent and vulnerable about things that we're feeling. And I think that also goes back to your point about the diagnoses. Like, we don't have to just diagnose someone. Mm-hmm. First of all, we shouldn't be doing that. I think we do often. They're like, oh, they seem real depressed. Mm-hmm. And it's like, okay, well, maybe we shouldn't, you know, put that out there. But with that being said, it's just kind of identifying these different things that we're seeing. So can you talk a little bit to our listeners about things that you can identify, particularly in younger children, in terms of mental health needs that they might have to have?
I think with starting with the youngest kids, it's as simple as identifying emotions. So naming those big emotions that they're feeling when they're happening, and rather than telling them to stop those negative emotions, although they can be quite big, right? We understand that you know, saying it's okay, right? I can tell you're feeling sad right now, you know, and that's okay. And I think it's easy to forget to do that, but I think that's one of the most important things with those kiddos that are really really young.
And trying to get them to just explain, like, hey, this is what I'm feeling. I don't really know exactly what I'm feeling, but, you know, this my heart hurts, or, you know, mm-hmm. When is it when people talk about sadness? And I know this is something big, talking about depression and anxiety. When is it too long where you feel like you might need to step in? If I have a student or if there's a kid that's around me and they're constantly kind of talking about they're sad or they're feeling, you know, they don't feel well. They're having kind of like these anxious moments. How long is too long before someone really needs to step in?
I mean, I think when it comes to kids, talking about that all the time is beneficial, even mm-hmm. if it's not like a formal intervention, but just to saying, you know, just talking about it all the time. But then additionally, the biggest kind of rule of thumb is when it starts to really impair everyday functioning. So if most people are anxious when they have to take a test, mm-hmm. right? But if it gets to the point where the child doesn't even want to come to school because they have a test that day, or they go to school, but then they get into fights, you know, mm-hmm. every time they're going to have a test, that's impairing their daily functioning. Mm-hmm. And that's when we probably need a bigger intervention than, you know, a casual conversation. And with kids, I think another important thing to think about is that depression and anxiety can show up as irritability and anger very often.
That's a great point.
I mean, that's actually true for adults too, but it's very true for young people. And so, you know, I think what sadly happens in schools a lot is we have kids that have a lot of anger and big behaviors, and they get identified as being behavior problems when it's actually probably more likely some underlying mental health stuff that's mm-hmm. not getting addressed. And so I think for adults who work with kids, it's important to understand the full range of how mental health issues show up.
Mm-hmm. So with this 3.59, you gotta get all the numbers in there. What was the process of including everything that you all are talking about today in this grant? Was a long process, was a lot of paperwork. What did you all really have to do in order to get this? It's a big sum of money, and I'm sure it was very competitive. So what were some of the things that were strategic, particularly in our region, that you thought was like kind of like, this is what got us this grant?
I think pretty early on, Anna identified Erie Wimbosis as being a really ideal partners because you had worked with them before. Mm-hmm. And then we quickly, I think, moved into conversations with them and had conversations about where were the gaps in the mm-hmm. community. And that's where the rural focus really came from, was the experience of the partners at BOCES. And then there was a lot of writing and coordination. And it did happen in a very compressed time frame, unfortunately, and late nights.
Trying to get that number count.
Yeah, it's hard to get a grant, and there's a lot of pieces to keep track of. And I think the school social work has pretty good infrastructure to support mm-hmm. faculty in doing that. The other thing that I thought was helpful, like it was funny, as we were writing, I was like, oh, this is good. This actually helps us. The school social work has had over almost 20 years now of focusing on trauma-informed care. Mm-hmm. And that has been an emphasis in the school social work. And so it folds in very nicely to say, we've been doing this. We teach our students this. They have an entire course on trauma-informed approaches and trauma and human rights. So it just all fit very nicely with what we've already been doing and what we have a history of doing well.
Mm-hmm. I think that speaks to Western New York as a whole. I think we always have these, you know, they always say like, keep Buffalo a secret. I feel like sometimes mm-hmm. we keep some of ourselves too much of a secret. Mm-hmm. And when we actually put ourselves out there, particularly nationally, folks are like, oh, you all are doing this work? Okay, great. Here's the money to do it. And, you know, it's interesting because as often as we speak about these different counties and these different districts, we do tend to forget about the rural community. So I thought that was really, you know, smart on your end, it's smart stars that you all have. It was smart on your end to really make sure that we include our rural communities, because so often we just tend to forget about them, and we don't have the access, you know, vice versa. We don't have access to them all the time, and they don't have all the access to us all the time. And particularly that work pipeline, you know, they deserve to have social workers and not just one. You know, I can't even really imagine that one person in a district just, you know, trying to deal with anything that every kid is bringing up to them, and, you know, and teachers and, you know, principals and administrators and all those different things. So that is, you know, wonderful that you all did that. And I, you know, I commend you all for including the rural communities in this fellowship and in the grant. So how can folks that are interested, students or community members, how can they get involved and support this new fellowship and initiative?
Yeah, so I think getting the word out about it is really important. So starting in the fall, we're starting now to recruit our UB social work students who might be interested in becoming a school social worker. We'll invite them to apply for the fellowship. And then the other component, the UB STARS, will start the following fall of 2026. And so particularly those community members in our partnering rural districts, if you yourself or you know of anybody who is interested in becoming a social worker, we would encourage you to reach out, because we are looking forward to recruiting and training the next generation of school social workers.
Now, social workers, and I know mental health specialists, are like on the rise. I think you guys were like one of the top five jobs that people need right now. So can you speak a little bit more to the importance of that, and why are folks really trying to get folks into social work and into these more mental, specialized mental health services?
I mean, there's a shortage nationally in the mental health workforce, and we feel it very much in Buffalo and in the region. And I'm sure, Katie, you hear this too, talking to agencies, they're just like, we cannot get enough workers. It's hard to keep them. It's just really difficult. And so, I mean, the grant's focus federally is to just increase the numbers of people who can do the work. I think what's also really important that the grant is also focused on very intently is making sure that we have diversity in the workforce. And so, like, it's not going to help if we just have a bunch of the same people doing the work across different communities, because not all communities look the same. So the benefit of really trying to recruit from within the rural communities that we're partnered with means that more people with rural experience, lived experience, will be in the mental health workforce. And that, I think, is very dramatic. And we've been doing that with other populations over time, and we're seeing the results of that. But that has not been so focused on for people who have grown up in rural areas and have experience in that. So I think that's a really nice benefit. And, you know, hopefully that's something that will change the whole face of the mental health workforce eventually.
Yes, we need you all, right? Dr. Stocker and Dr. Ball, I'm going to ask both of you the same question, but what can you all share about this fellowship and convey to our listeners the importance of mental health and the needs in rural schools? Do like a quick summary for folks.
Yeah. So again, I think there's just that workforce shortage in mental health service professionals in rural areas. I think that specific for youth, I think schools are one of the best places to provide these mental health services, particularly in rural areas. And so we have UB social work students who are really excited to get the experience working in schools and to get the specialized training from the fellowship. So I think we've really kind of aligned need and interest between the school and the community, and I'm excited about the partnership.
Yeah, I think similarly, when there are mental health difficulties, it's just really hard for people to thrive. And so anything we can do to address that can have huge benefits. And addressing it can look like all kinds of different things. And I think that's also useful, because it doesn't mean that it's necessarily going to be long and intensive and difficult. And I think that's where social workers come in. Social workers are trained in understanding the evidence behind different interventions and they're able to translate that into practice, and they're able to make decisions about which interventions will work best for whom. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, we love social workers, right? but I think they have a very specific skill set that merges the direct individual practice and the broader understanding of the community and cultural context, policy, and we kind of bring it all together. And I think that's unique to social workers. And I just hope that more of us can keep doing the work so that we're able to kind of be that connection. And that's especially true in schools. School social workers often say that they're the connection between the school, the family, and the community. And this is where we sit in the middle. Right. And that is really how school social workers characterize themselves. So I think it's ideal to be in those settings to do that.
Yes, and we need you all. And I'm so grateful for you all being here with us today. And also congratulations, because this is a wonderful opportunity, not just for University of Buffalo, but also our community at large here in Western New York. Thank you, Dr. Stalker and Dr. Ball, for joining us today and sharing this vital information. We appreciate your dedication to improving mental health services in our rural communities.
Thank you
to our listeners for tuning in to WBFO's What's Next. Stay tuned for more discussions on the issues that matter to you.